Oh, you might be surprised. I stare at him. Care for a cup of tea, Major? I say, are you Kurtz? He carefully sets out small metal cups for the brewed tea. Apparently so, he says, smiling. The chocolate bars were passed over to Kurtz, and my weapon and rucksack were returned to me. I now hold a filled cup in my hand, but don't take a sip. Hell of a welcoming committee, I say. What's your problem? He shrugs. No problem. I didn't feel like having visitors today. That's why I didn't answer. In 2 weeks, there's a scheduled resupply drop, and your pilot wasn't sending along the necessary code groups to let me know about an unscheduled visit. He pours tea in other cups and the men reach forward. I figure you get a bit roughed up, you'll bring the message back to wherever you came from not to come up for some tourist visit. I say, this isn't a tourist visit. Oh, my apologies, he says. Who are you then, and why are you here? Major Jeremiah Cook, I say. I'm with the Army CID. Criminal investigations? Really? I'm afraid you have zero jurisdiction over me and my men. It's not involving your actions, I say. I'm investigating the arrest stateside of a Ranger squad that was under your temporary command, headed by Staff Sergeant Caleb Jefferson, Alpha Company, 4th Battalion. A slight smile through the beard. Ah, yes, the famed ninjas. Damn, they're good. I'd give them a house to raid, and I don't know how they did it so well. Concealment, taking their time, using distractions. But they could raid the house before the dogs even started barking. What happened to them stateside? I say, 4 of them were arrested for multiple homicides, killing 7 civilians in a house. The cup is in midair. That's pretty screwed up. Do you think they did it? All the forensic evidence and the witnesses say so, I say. But now the witnesses and most of the evidence are gone. One of the Rangers committed suicide in his cell, and I learned they were set up for an attack committed in a village here in Afghanistan. Pendahar. He takes a long sip of his tea. Yeah, poor Taliban bastards were getting pretty chewed up in that district. They wanted to set up a war crime incident, blame the ninjas, get world opinion once again set against the great Satan. Happily for everyone, they suck at making home movies. But they were still sent home early, weren't they? With that potential war crime being used as an excuse, when they were under your command. Ah, that's right. What happened when they were working for you? He puts his cup down on the stone and dirt floor. The 5 Afghan tribesmen have been watching our conversation with intent, their heads moving back and forth like they're watching a tennis match. Sorry, Major Cook, that is way above your pay grade, your position, your station in life. I say, Mr. Kurtz, please. Staff Sergeant Jefferson is pleading guilty today and is about to be sentenced for those murders. And the other 2 Rangers? Apparently they will be set free in exchange for Jefferson pleading guilty. Sounds like the Staff Sergeant. I say, sounds like he's protecting his fire team. But why? I don't think he did what he's charged with in Georgia. But their arrests in Georgia came after they were sent home early. Why? What happened here? Kurtz stares at me and I say, Mr. Kurtz, I'm here under no authority or orders. I've been on an aircraft and in convoys for the last 40 hours. However my mission wraps up here, I'm heading straight to a court-martial. When that happens, I'd like to think this wasn't all a waste, that I found out what really happened to Staff Sergeant Jefferson and his Rangers. Kurtz picks up his cup, takes another sip. Mine is getting cold and I don't really give a shit. I say, you say you worked with them, admired them. Why won't you help them? He says, doubt it will help at this point in time. Please. He pours himself more tea. One night they went on a raid. Where? Doesn't matter. They hit the right house, but it was empty. Nobody home. It happens. Sometimes the best intelligence gets fouled up. They were then heading back to their pickup point when they heard screams. Not their business, not their problem, but Staff Sergeant Jefferson, he's not made like that. Someone was in pain, being tortured, and he and his crew were going to stop it. Did they? They did, he says. But there were complications. What kind of complications? The ones that sent them home early to Georgia and sent me up to this remote slice of paradise. Chapter 91. After the words, "The Honorable Judge Howell Rollins presiding," fade away, Lieutenant John Huang leans closer to Pierce and says, "We've got to do something." "Like what?" Pierce says, feeling on the spot, remembering the urgent words from Agent Sanchez up there in Savannah, keeping guard over a wounded Agent Cook. "Protect the Rangers." He says to Huang, "I don't have standing here, Doc. You know that."
"But you know something's going on with the sheriff," he urgently says. "We both know it." Pierce says, "What the hell do you want me to do? Interrupt the proceedings? Yell out that the army is here and we know your sheriff is a crook and is planning to kill this army ranger? Hell, considering what he's charged with, most of the people in this town would be fine with it."
Pierce sees one of the courtroom officers, an older male with a paunch who looks like ex-military, staring at him and Huang, and he shuts up. District Attorney Cornelius Slate is up at the judge's bench, talking to the judge, and overhead, huge fans are slowly moving, trying to stir up the dead air. Abruptly, the district attorney goes back to his table, and the judge says, "All right, Gene, bring in the sergeant, will you?" The court officer, who earlier had been staring at them, goes through the door near the clerk's station and comes back with Staff Sergeant Caleb Jefferson. He's dressed in the same orange prison jumpsuit, with Ralston PD Jail in black letters on the back. His hands are cuffed, and he moves with grace and confidence, like whatever is going to happen today is a minor annoyance, nothing else. There are whispers and a few comments after Jefferson comes in, including one woman's harsh voice,
"Baby killer!"
But the ranger goes to the front of the table directly next to the district attorney's and patiently stands there. The old judge at the bench makes a soft rap with his gavel and says, "Okay, folks, simmer down. We're about to begin." Pierce is reminded of those dreams he has when he's under some heavy stress, the dreams of going to class and realizing that today is exam day, or the dreams of ending a semester and finding an old class schedule, realizing that he's forgotten to attend an important class all these past months. These dreams are nothing compared to what's happening now, as the ranger just a few feet away from him, a fellow service member, is being railroaded and, based on the sheriff's record for removing evidence, will be dead in a day or two. Protect the Rangers. But how? Chapter 92. Afghanistan. The CIA man sighs.
"But don't feel sorry for me, Major Cook. Working back there near Khost, I had forms to fill out, superiors to satisfy, and company lawyers on my back making sure I didn't cross any magic lines that had been drawn the previous week in D.C. Here it's like something out of Lawrence of Arabia. Just me and these fine fellows. I find it liberating, clean, precise."
As much as I want to press him, he seems to be in a mood, and I don't want to disturb it.
"What do you do here, and how can you
trust them?" Kurtz asks.
"Is that what you're asking? Well, a few things work in my favor. Deep back there in the rock is my quarters, with a safe that automatically changes its combination every 24 hours. In there is $1 million or so that I dole out at appropriate times, and these tribesmen love to fight. They've been fighting one another for centuries and will continue to do so even when we have colonies on Mars. And 2 tours ago, I converted to Islam. I'm now part of the tribe, not an infidel."
He says something in Pashto to the men, and they all laugh with pleasure. Kurt says to Cook,
"Up here, we keep an eye on local rat lines in the deep valleys and ravines, bringing in men from Pakistan. We've got observers in all the local villages. Don't care what tribe they're from or if they're crossing borders, but if they're Al-Qaeda, ISIS, any foreign fighters, they come to a nasty and bloody end."
"But you're so isolated, remote."
He smiles through his thick beard.
"I've got the finest communication gear the company can provide, and there are air packages overhead at my disposal. Whenever my guys run into something bigger than they can handle, or if the Taliban try to assault my little fort here, I send a call up to the Air Force. You know, the fellows you use when you want to send the very best."
"Now,
I think. Now. Good for you, Mr. Kurtz, I say. Whatever happened back then, whatever complications ensued, it sent you to your dream job, and it sent those rangers to jail. His happy mood is gone. I push him. What happened? Are you going to sit up here like some new T.E. Lawrence while men you worked with, men you trusted, men who served this country are being treated with disgrace, imprisoned, ruined? Kurt says, probably too late. I'm the investigator here. Let me decide. His fellow tribesmen sense a change in their leader's mood. They look at me with hate, from friend to enemy in a matter of seconds. Kurt sighs. They went to a house when they heard screaming from inside. They should have ignored it. We're not here to give the Afghan people the Bill of Rights or copies of the Federalist Papers or anything similar. We can't change thousands of years of history. What was going on? Kurtz rubs at his beard. It was an arrangement. A welcoming gift to a foreign visitor who was promising lots of millions of dollars of additional aid. An American who was taking advantage of the local world, with no bloggers or journalists nearby, fulfilling his needs. A man with a 12-year-old. He pauses. A 12-year-old boy. The rangers broke in and stopped him? Yes. God. Then it comes to me, like a series of lightning flashes in the distant sky, remembering a man with a woman at a campaign rally, expressing his support of the troops and how he had visited them on the battleground.
Chapter 93. Staff Sergeant Caleb Jefferson is in a familiar place, standing at attention in front of a supposed superior. Even with his hands cuffed in front of him, he's still maintaining his military bearing. The judge is an old man who looks like he keeps photos of his grandpappy in clan robes in a secret drawer in his desk. But he starts off the process by reading some official paperwork, and the droning goes on and on. Jefferson looks around the courtroom, crowded with reporters, locals, law enforcement, and standing up against the wall, the army doc and lawyer back there, looking tired and discouraged. Poor guys. They thought they could help him and his men. Nope. Wasn't going to happen. He, Staff Sergeant Caleb Jefferson, 2nd Platoon, Alpha Company, 4th Battalion, is going to take care of his men. Jefferson spots Sheriff Emma Williams sitting in the front row, arms folded, looking pretty damn pleased with herself. Same look as a week ago.
Chapter 94. Afghanistan. The memory from that time at the campaign rally back in Sullivan is fresh in my mind, and I say the American was a congressman from Georgia. Kurtz grins. He was. And he was being escorted by a woman public affairs officer from the Georgia National Guard. A happy nod.
Damn, you are a good investigator, Major Cook.
What happened?
What do you think happened? The Rangers weren't officially there. Nothing officially happened, and to make sure I kept quiet, that woman made some calls, pulled a few strings, and here I am.
A thump shakes the little bunker, and dust falls from the overhead rocks.
Ah, shit, Kurt says. Looks like the Mooj want to let us know they're around.
Another, closer thump. I turn. Mortars?
The same, he says. Excuse me, I've got to get to work.
But...
Sorry, pal, you're our guest for the foreseeable future.
He snaps out a series of orders in Pashto. The men grab their AK-47s, and Kurt stands up, pulling aside a nearby blanket.
Come along, Major. We're going to wait this one out.
The men rush past me as I look at Kurt's, then grab my rucksack and head outside. Kurtz yells but doesn't follow me as I go after his men, who are moving under the netting, taking up binoculars and grid maps. Looking out, two of them talking quickly on handheld radios, probably trying to reach their observers out there among the rocky peaks. The sun is setting. I check my watch. I've been here 19 minutes. Where is Chief Salucci? Where's his little bird helicopter? 20 minutes. 21 minutes. The Night Stalkers pride themselves in arriving on time at a mission, give or take 30 seconds. I have the information to free the Rangers back in Georgia. Kurtz's statement combined with my eventual recovery of travel records and manifests to show Representative Conover and Sheriff Williams were here in Pendahar. And I'm stuck here on a rock in a mountain wilderness with men out there trying to kill me. 22 minutes. Is Salucci still out there? Was he called to another mission? Is my watch wrong? A louder, closer mortar explosion tosses up dust, rock fragments, and knocks me down.
Chapter 95. Almost a week ago, Staff Sergeant Caleb Jefferson's chest hurt, his arms hurt, and his eyes were sore from the pepper spray used during his arrest at the roadhouse. He and his guys had been unwinding there two nights after tuning up that drug-dealing creep who nearly killed his stepdaughter. Even his wrists bled from where the metal cuffs dug in. Across from his cell in the Ralston jail, seated before him was the county sheriff, whom he immediately recognized. The last time she had been in an army uniform outside Pendahar in Afghanistan, screaming and slapping a naked congressman in a ratty hovel with two Afghan businessmen in western suits looking on in amusement. "Well," she said, "here's a situation, Staff Sergeant."
"Go on," he said.
"You and your boys saw something you shouldn't have seen back in Afghanistan. You saw a good man falling to temptation. A man who will do great things for this nation. A man who will become a senator in under 2 weeks."
"Some man," he said.
She said, "All great men have their faults. FDR, JFK, Martin Luther King Jr. Yet they did great things for their nation. As the congressman will do when he gets back to Washington as a senator this time."
Jefferson stayed silent. He knew where this was going.
"But here's the situation," Williams said. "How do I keep you and your three boys quiet about what you thought you heard and saw back in Afghanistan?"
"I'm certain about what I saw and heard," he said. "As are my men."
A slight toss of the shoulders. "Not going to debate that, which goes back to my original problem. Keeping you quiet, which is why you're here. You see, we know what you and the other Rangers did at the summer house, you beating up Stuart Pike. Maybe that could have been enough to keep you quiet, me holding that over your heads, but I doubted it. So later, well, bad things happen to bad people."
Jefferson clenched his fists. "What the hell are you talking about?"
"Bad things," she said. "Gunmen later went in there and killed everybody in that home. There's forensic evidence and witnesses placing you four Rangers at the scene. You're all under arrest. You're here until I say otherwise, and you'll stay here until the Wednesday after the election, and then, oops, you'll get released. Faulty evidence and all that. Then you'll keep your mouth shut. Forever. Because, Staff Sergeant, there's no statute of limitations for murder, and it's amazing what new evidence can pop up at the right time."
Jefferson gave her one good hard stare, and she returned the favor. He said, "I get a phone call. I get a lawyer. I tell him or her everything you just told me here. How's that for evidence?" Then, like a sniper shot coming from nowhere, hitting him right in the center of his ballistic plating, taking his breath away, the sheriff said,
"And how's your lovely stepdaughter doing? Carol, right? Carol Crosby?"
Jefferson couldn't talk.
"She's at the Damon Harbor Rehabilitation Facility, isn't she? Over in Hilton Head, second floor. Her day nurse is Sonny Law. Her night nurse is Kim Christo. Damn close thing it was, her nearly getting killed."
The sheriff scooted her metal chair up closer to the bars.
"You damn idiot, how do you think that Pike fella got that fentanyl to your stepdaughter, huh? By accident?"
He closed his eyes. He wanted to break down this cell door and kill this smug sheriff sitting in front of him. But that wasn't possible.
All right, he said. My mouth is shut. The same for my guys.
Then you get free that Wednesday morning and your mouth stays shut, Jefferson said.
All right. Me and my three guys, that's what we'll do.
The sheriff grinned, slapped her hands together in satisfaction, stood up.
Wonderful. Hey, no hard feelings, all right, Staff Sergeant. You and your rangers were just in the wrong place at the wrong time,
he said.
Sheriff, that's our damn job description.
Jefferson snaps to, keeping an eye on the judge, feeling the eyes of the sheriff nearly bore a hole into his unprotected back. So what? With Vinnie Tyler dead, the deal has changed. It's on him, and only him. His guys go free, and he'll keep his mouth shut. And right now, he's sure Major Frank Moore has kept his promise of working with his Aunt Sophie to move his stepdaughter Carol to another, safer facility. Jefferson will do anything and everything to protect his remaining guys and Carol. A dark, deep memory of his dying wife, Melissa, her whispering,
"You protect my girl, Caleb Jefferson. You do that."
Staff Sergeant Jefferson?
Sir, he asks.
The judge says,
"Before we proceed, I just want to ensure that you are here of your own free will, that you have decided to waive counsel, and that you plan to represent yourself. Is that correct, Staff Sergeant Jefferson?"
He says the words with force and certainty.
"Yes, Your Honor."
"All right," the judge says.
"We will proceed."
Chapter 96. Afghanistan. I get up, coughing, touch my forehead, pull away my hand and see bloody fingers. My ears are ringing, the men are shouting, smoke and clouds of dust are drifting away. Two more explosions, thump, thump, hit the other side of this peak, the ground shaking from the impacts. I scramble up, cough some more, find my rucksack. A heavy thrumming noise bursts out like a high-speed M134 minigun. Its rotating barrel shooting out thousands of rounds every minute, and I duck and scramble across the rocky surface, thinking, when in the hell did the Taliban get that weapon? As a black little bird helicopter roars up into view from a deep ravine, circles and then flares down to a landing, its engine sounding just like a weapon. I grab my rucksack, lower my bleeding head, and run as fast and as best as I can to the churning little aircraft that represents my way out of here. My way to get the Rangers free. Dust and gravel roar around me, and the passenger door opens up. Chief Salucci is leaning across the empty seat. I can't hear what he's yelling, but I'm sure it's move, move, move. Unlike before, I have no difficulty getting into the little bird. I toss my rucksack into the rear, get into the seat, grab the crash helmet. The next few seconds are a crazed blur as Salucci lifts the helicopter before I can even get the seatbelt and harness fastened. The little bird seems to fly up just a score of meters or so, Salucci wrestling with the controls before it dives fast into the right, dipping into the ravine. I clench my teeth, trying hard not to vomit. The helicopter bounces up and down as we skim over another wide peak, and I get my seatbelt and harness fastened, cinching it as tight as possible. It takes two good tries to get the helmet on, and I fumble with the communications gear before Salucci's voice comes through loud and clear.
"Did you get what you needed?" he asks.
"Yes." Salucci swears, hops up over another rocky ridge.
"Good, because they're about to get hammered. Saw lots of movement heading their way."
I say, "How long before we get back to the FOB?
10-15 minutes if I push it," Salucci says.
"Push it," I say. "Can you raise the Ranger detachment there, Major West?"
"I'll see."
A flare of light just ahead of us. Tracer rounds come from a heavy machine gun set in the rocks before us, reaching up and up, wanting to touch us and... Salucci swears, powers us to the left. We dive, desperately trying to get ahead of the tracer rounds. The ground is so close it looks like it can reach up and slap us hard. Instead, the bullets get to us first. It sounds like a sledgehammer is pounding the metal. Alarms start sounding from the instrument panel, flashing red lights. Salucci says,
"Brace for..."
We hit, bounce, upside down, hit again, go dark.
Chapter 97. Sitting comfortably on the crowded bench in the Sullivan County courtroom, Sheriff Emma Williams doesn't mind being closed in. She feels like she's in some sort of religious ceremony, where the powers of right, meaning her, of course, are about to get their due. The courtroom is as it should be, even with that bitch Peggy Reese of the Sullivan County Times sitting on the other set of benches, quickly scribbling in her reporter's notebook as if she'll be the one to scoop all the media rivals on this. For years, Williams has ignored the woman, being just a little irritant in her day-to-day business, but once she gets to D.C., she'll send word to her deputy, Clark Lindsay, that this situation needs to be resolved. Earlier today, she received a text from a detective at the Savannah Police Department saying that her poor deputy Dwight Dix had been shot yesterday in an apparent robbery at a Waffle House near Savannah, and could she give him a call when she's free? Yeah, she thinks, tomorrow, considering how her day is going. Before her, Judge Howell Rollins continues his droning, pausing every now and then for a heavy cough.
In the name of and on behalf of the citizens of the state of Georgia, charge and accuse Caleb Jefferson with the offense of malice murder, for that the said Caleb Jefferson, in the county of Sullivan and the state of Georgia, on or about the 21st of October, did unlawfully, with malice aforethought, cause the death of Stuart Pike, a human being, by shooting Stuart Pike with a handgun, contrary to the laws of the state of Georgia, the good order, peace, and dignity thereof. The judge coughs. Mr. Jefferson, how do you plead to this charge?
Williams takes another look around at the quiet spectators, and then she hears the staff sergeant say in that strong voice,
guilty.
How confident. Time to shake that arrogant man's confidence.
On or about the 21st of October, did unlawfully, with malice aforethought, cause the death of Lillian Zachary, a human being?
More blah, blah, blah from that alcoholic judge, and then again Jefferson's voice,
guilty.
From her pants pocket, she takes out a newspaper clipping from yesterday's Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Waits.
On or about the 21st of October, did unlawfully, with malice aforethought, cause the death of Polly Zachary, a human being.
At the mention of the little girl, more sighs and muttered voices from the courtroom attendees, and when the noise settles down, Jefferson doesn't hesitate at all.
Guilty, he says. The last name.
She waits for Judge Howell Rollins to make the final arrangements, gavel everything to a conclusion so that Jefferson will be taken into her county jail, when he shakes his head, wipes at his lips, and says,
15-minute recess.
He slaps the gavel down and stands up from the bench, and the courtroom attendant shouts out, All rise! Williams can't help herself. She turns to the woman standing next to her and whispers loudly,
Looks like the judge needs a rise, too.
And there's laughter. The judge's face flushes in embarrassment. He probably heard what Williams just said, but so what? This is her county. Yesterday, today, tomorrow, and next week, forever. When the judge leaves and everyone sits down, she catches the attention of Cornelius Slate, the district attorney, and beckons him over. He walks to her, puzzled, and she leans over the court railing, hands him the newspaper clipping. Here, she says, take this to Staff Sergeant Jefferson. Slate looks at the newspaper clipping.
Why?
Because I said so, she says. Get a move on, Corny, before the judge comes back. As a good boy, Slate walks over to the Army Ranger, puts the newspaper clipping on the table, and walks back to his chair. Staff Sergeant Caleb Jefferson glances at the newsprint, and it's like he's just been transported from this safe Georgia courtroom to an FOB in the stand, guys yelling, They're coming through the wire! The same feeling of danger, of impending death. A dizzying feeling that the safety of 1 minute ago is gone forever. The headline reads, Body of murdered Ranger officer recovered. There's a small photo of Major Frank Moore, and he doesn't bother reading the story. Moore is dead. The man who was going to protect his stepdaughter, Carol. He turns in his seat and sees the happy, smiling face of Sheriff Williams looking at him, and if it weren't for the armed men in this room, he would leap over the railing and strangle her with his handcuffed hands. Chapter 98, Afghanistan.
I come to, resting on my side on a bunch of sharp rocks. What a goddamn mess. I turn and grind my teeth at the pain. The crumpled metal and broken glass and torn cables from what was once a multi-million-dollar and gorgeous flying machine lay all around me. All I see is the destroyed little bird and lots of rocks. My legs are stuck. I gingerly move them. Both hurt like hell, as well as my left hip. I cough, blood in my mouth. "Hey, Chief," I call out. "You there, Chief?" I hear the sound of the wind and the snap crackle of electric circuitry shorting out somewhere. Nothing else. I smell spilt aviation fuel and the memory of being trapped in that shattered Humvee and seeing the flames approach my trapped legs makes me start shaking. "Not again," I whisper, "please God, not again." There's a glow of something still working in the shattered instrument panel, and as my eyes adjust, I see the slumped form of Chief Salucci, still fastened in his seat, dangling upside down, his arms free. "Chief," I call out. "Hey, Chief, are you okay?" My eyes adjust better to the deepening darkness. A piece of metal broken from the helicopter's frame has gone right through his neck and out the back. Guilt hits me like a cold wave. The man is dead because of me. Because I bribed him to take me on an unauthorized trip to see a CIA guy. And for nothing. I tug again at my legs, grit my teeth in pain. I roll to the left, see my rucksack. I strain and strain with my left arm, grab a strap, drag it over to me. It takes a lot out of me. I close my eyes, catch my breath. At least the crackling of the circuitry is gone. Maybe the damn thing won't catch fire after all. Something is digging into my right hip. I move around, take out my Sig Sauer. Worthless for the moment. I wonder what's going on in Georgia, how the Rangers are doing. How that meeting with Connie and someone involved with the shooting went. Has she found out what I now know? That this whole mess began here in Afghanistan, when the Rangers stumbled across something they shouldn't have witnessed. I open my eyes, yank the top of my rucksack, manage to get it open. I push my right hand in, dig around, a few items falling out. There. Got the Iridium satellite phone. I breathe hard, bring it up, push the power button. Nothing. The small screen remains dark. I push the button again and again. The satellite phone is dead. I drop it, take up the Sig Sauer, put it into the open rucksack. It's almost completely dark and a few stars appear overhead. I think I hear voices. I stop moving. Damn, I'm not thinking anymore. I am hearing voices. Fear is digging right into my gut. A memory comes to me of the research I did before my first deployment to Afghanistan and the books I read, including the poetry of Rudyard Kipling and his tales of British soldiers serving in India and Afghanistan. A stanza comes right to my mind about what a young British soldier should do if wounded on Afghanistan's plains, and when the Afghan women came down at you with knives, just roll to your rifle and blow out your brains and go to your God like a soldier. I whisper, but I'm no soldier. I'm just a goddamn cop. A wounded, trapped, and alone cop at that. I try again to free my legs, but the pain digs in deep, like hidden knives are carving me up. The voices grow louder. I hear the approaching men, but I can't understand what they're saying, yet I know what they're saying. Here's a shot down American helicopter. Let's see who's alive.
A light comes on, illuminating the wreckage. The dead body of the chief, and then me. That's when I go to the rucksack for one final, desperate gamble. Chapter 99. Captain Alan Pierce is waiting for the judge to come back from his unexpected break, wondering what he's going to do next. A minute after the judge left, which was nearly a half hour ago and definitely not 15 minutes, there was a look exchanged between Sheriff Williams and Staff Sergeant Jefferson. A look of hate from the ranger, a look of satisfaction from the sheriff. The ranger is about to be sentenced for the 7 homicides committed here just over a week ago, or as it's called in this state, malice murder, and yet he's staring at the sheriff. Not the judge, not the district attorney who's representing the state. What is going on here? Huang whispers, Alan, you've got to do something. Pierce whispers back, like what? Raise my hand? Throw myself on the mercy of the judge? Does he look like somebody who's flexible enough to bend the rules and let an outsider lawyer interrupt? Pierce wants to say something else, but what's the point? Seeing Staff Sergeant Jefferson sitting by himself, an African-American defendant in this courtroom at this time with so many of the court audience being white? How many of Jefferson's brothers and sisters, hell, Pierce's own brothers and sisters, have been in a similar position, facing alleged justice with a white judge in a nearly all-white group of residents? He's no bomb thrower and knows a lot of progress has been made, but seeing Jefferson up there just stirs old history and old memories in him. Seeing the relaxed nature of the attendees in the courtroom, enjoying the break to talk and gossip with their neighbors, Sheriff Williams even holding court with 4 locals who've come up to talk to her, strengthens those old memories. So many cases of black defendants being railroaded. The staff sergeant looks back again to the smiling sheriff, sitting in all her glory. Why is this ranger allowing himself to be railroaded? Why is he doing this? Huang's voice comes back to him. You've got to do something. The door opens up and the court attendant calls out, All rise! As the judge slowly walks in and back up to the bench. The attendees stand up and the judge gavels the session back into order. How many times has Pierce heard those words from scared defendants he's represented over the years, facing minor offenses that would ruin a career, or after a drunken brawl that got out of hand or a mistaken case of auto theft? All those defendants looking to him to find some obscure phrase or reference in a law book to set them free. You've got to do something. The judge says, Staff Sergeant Jefferson, I'm going to take a few minutes to repeat myself here just so there's no misunderstanding. Now, before I pass sentence, I need to confirm once more for my own peace of mind that you are here of your own free will.
I am, Your Honor.
That you're not under the influence of alcohol or drugs.
I am not, Your Honor.
That no threats or pressure have been made upon you to enter this guilty plea, correct?
Just the slightest bit of hesitation that Pierce notices from Jefferson. A slight tensing of the ranger's shoulders.
Not a single threat or mention of pressure, Your Honor, he says.
Something is not right. Something is wrong.
You've got to do something.
He steps forward, trying to formulate something he'll say after yelling, Your Honor, please, when his iPhone suddenly chimes. Incoming text. The judge stares at him. The district attorney turns to look at him. Almost everyone in the courtroom is now looking at him. He brings up the iPhone, slides his fingers across, sees the text, and shakes his head in amazement.
By God. He is going to do something.
Chapter 100. Afghanistan.
I find myself awake again. My left hip and legs are still twisting and burning and crawling with pain. I look up, see chiseled rock and stone. I'm in a place, somewhere. I spit, blood still in my mouth. What the hell has happened? The foreign voices continue talking out there, and I wish I had spent some time learning Pashto back in the day. It might have been useful. Might have been.
The voices grow louder. I now remember what's happened in the last long minutes, and as I hear the footsteps of the men coming toward me, I close my eyes, and it goes dark again.
Chapter 101. Sheriff Emma Williams of Sullivan County thinks it's about time Judge Howell Rollins steps down, because that brief recess stretched to nearly an hour, and it's a wonder the old drunk can keep his eyes open. But her thoughts and mood are abruptly interrupted by the sound of someone's handheld device sounding off. Who, boy, as she thinks, someone is about to get their ass in a sling because the judge hates cell phones and hates being interrupted. But before the judge can say a word, that smart-alecky army lawyer steps forward and starts talking in a loud voice.
Your Honor, if I may please approach the bench, sir, my name is Alan Pierce, and I'm an army captain serving in the Judge Advocate General's Corps.
Loud murmurs and talk from the spectators, and Rollins hammers down his gavel twice.
Are you here to represent Staff Sergeant Jefferson? I'm sorry to tell you that opportunity is gone. That ship has sailed, Captain Pierce.
I understand, Your Honor, the lawyer says. I'm here as part of the Army investigation into those homicides and the alleged participation of the Rangers who were arrested.
At last, Corny Slate stands up and says,
Your Honor, this is unacceptable. There is no alleged participation. There is evidence from the county sheriff's investigation, overwhelming evidence that's led to this army sergeant pleading guilty.
The army lawyer steps up to the bar and says, Your Honor, please, I beg for a few minutes' indulgence, that's all. I've just received an urgent text from Afghanistan saying there is evidence in that country that will be key to determining whether your sentencing should go forward.
Judge Rollins's already red face gets more crimson.
Are you telling me, son, that some judge over there in that third world country is trying to tell me how to run my courtroom?
The JAG lawyer, leather bag in his right hand, shakes his head.
Not at all, Your Honor, not at all. In the interest of seeing that the very best outcome is made today, sir, please, will you allow me to approach the bench for a few moments? Please?
William stares at the judge in cold disbelief. What in the hell is going on here? Afghanistan? For real? It was settled. It was buried. There should be no mention of Afghanistan at all in this sunny courtroom in Georgia. Not a word.
Rollins says, I'll allow it. No guarantees, you understand, but I'll allow it.
Thank you, Your Honor, the JAG lawyer says. You won't regret it.
Rollins barks out a laugh.
You better hope you're right.
The army lawyer steps through the bar's open gate. And as he approaches the bench, William stands up and violently gestures to get the district attorney's attention. Slate spots her and slinks over like a student about to be disciplined in public by a teacher, which is pretty accurate. She grabs a lapel of his suit jacket and gives it a good twist.
Corny, you go up there and stop this shit right now, got it? Shut it down or I swear to God I'll make it hurt for you so bad you'll still be crying 10 years from now. Go!
Williams pushes him away and returns to her seat, breathing hard, realizing that the courtroom has gone quiet and that most people are staring at her. Not the judge or the district attorney or that black army lawyer. Her. She sits down, watches the huddle up there, the army lawyer speaking, waving an arm around, and Corny doing the same thing, and the old fool Rollins listening to them both, rubbing at his face, nodding and speaking loudly.
All right, I've heard enough. Mr. Slate, you may return to your spot. Captain Pierce. All right, then.
Murmurs from the people around her, and even that big, tough staff sergeant over there in handcuffs and wearing a Ralston jail jumpsuit looks confused.
Sheriff Williams, the judge says.
She stands up, now confused as well.
Your Honor?
He crooks a finger at her and she nods, stumbles for a moment, and walks through the open gate of the bar and then up to the bench. The judge, of course, is sitting higher than her and she feels out of sorts and exposed. She doesn't like the feeling. Rollins covers the bench's microphone with his hand and in a low voice says,
Emma, just a bit closer. There. You know what?
She shakes her head.
What's that, Judge?
He smiles, his teeth yellow and stained.
I heard what you said a while back when I adjourned for recess, and you said I needed a rise too, right?
With horror, she realizes she's gone too far and says,
Judge Rollins, please, I apologize. I meant...
He shakes his head, his greasy-looking smile wide and confident, close enough that she's able to smell his peppermint-scented breath.
This may be your county, Emma, but this is my goddamn courtroom. I'll run it the way I see fit, especially if it pisses you off. Now go sit your fat ass down so we can see what the hell Afghanistan has to say.
Chapter 102. All right, Captain Alan Pierce thinks, standing nervously in front of the judge. Let's make sure this happens. From his leather briefcase, he takes out the Army issue laptop, places it on top of the judge's bench, powers it up. The screen pops into view. He starts checking the icons, goes through the applications folder, finds the one for Skype, double clicks. The icon rotates, rotates, rotates.
Counselor, the judge says.
He feels himself warm with embarrassment, remembering the first time he argued a case before a military tribunal and realized 10 minutes in that he had forgotten a key folder of paperwork back in his apartment. Just a moment, Your Honor, he says, clicking on the keyboard, hearing the titters and giggles from the spectators, knowing the sheriff is probably enjoying his every painful moment. Someone stands next to him.
If I may, Your Honor, I believe I can fix this, comes Huang's voice.
And who the hell are you?
Dr. John Huang, he says, gently pushing Pierce aside and going to the computer. I'm an Army lieutenant.
Well, the judge says, I guess if anyone can fix a computer, it's someone like you, huh? And this thing, Skip, you can actually talk to someone in Afghanistan?
Huang says, yes, sir, Skype.
Pierce feels sweet relief pour through him as the familiar logon page pops up. He goes to his iPhone, copies the address onto the Skype page, and the tone of its ringing sounds. He taps a key and boosts the volume, and a screen pops up, dark but visible. Sweet God, it's the Major. And he looks horrible. A tired-looking Major Jeremiah Cook peers at him, his face lined, worn, and with a growth of beard. Pierce maneuvers the laptop so his own face pops up within the screen.
Captain Pierce, Cook says, is the hearing for Staff Sergeant Jefferson concluded?
Almost, sir.
Is the judge nearby?
Right here, sir,
he says, rotating the screen so Judge Rollins can see Major Cook. This is Judge Howell Rollins. The judge leans in and says,
I'll be damned. Who is this?
The major coughs, grimaces.
I'm Major Jeremiah Cook with the U.S. Army Criminal Investigation Division, operating out of Quantico. I'm leading the team investigating the alleged involvement of the Rangers in the murders that happened last week in your county. Your Honor, thank you for allowing me to speak to you.
The judge says,
and where the hell are you anyway?
Pierce looks back at the spectators, and those who can see the screen are leaning forward. It's so quiet that besides the hiss of the computer's speakers, the only thing he can hear is the gentle whir-whir of the large fans overhead. The screen fades in and out. Cook says,
I'm at an observation post on a mountaintop somewhere in southern Afghanistan, pretty damn close to the Pakistan border. I've just interviewed a key witness who has vital information about this case.
The video screen vibrates and then settles down as a muffled boom is heard. Cook looks up.
Sorry, he says, there's a squad of Taliban coming up the north side of the ridge, and they're laying down some mortar rounds. I've got to make this quick.
Pierce sees that the arrogant and angry face of the judge has changed to something else entirely.
Go on, Major, go on, the judge says. Why are you in Afghanistan? What does anything over there have to do with Sullivan County and my court?
Another boom, another shake of the screen, and Cook continues, voice tired and strained.
During the course of our investigation, we learned that the Ranger fire team that was arrested in Sullivan County had been accused of committing a similar crime in a small village in Afghanistan. It seemed to be too much of a coincidence. I flew here and found out that this charge was false, that it was a setup by the local Taliban to accuse the Rangers of war crimes.
Rollins says,
Major, you're not telling me that the Taliban came over here and tried to do the same thing again, are you?
No, sir, not at all. But I believe that false accusation served as a template or an inspiration for someone down the line.
I know the staff sergeant is pleading guilty in exchange for letting his two surviving squad members go free. I believe he's doing this out of dedication and loyalty to his men. But please, Your Honor, please don't accept his plea. I've gathered information over here that I believe is vital to what's going on in Sullivan County.
Pierce hears other voices coming out of the speakers and Cook turns, nods, and says,
They're approaching the outer wire now, Your Honor.
Hurry up, Major, tell us what you found out,
the judge says, leaning farther over his bench.
A couple of months ago, the Rangers were sent home early from a regularly scheduled deployment. That happened days after the Rangers discovered a U.S. citizen raping an Afghan civilian in a private home in a small village. A young boy.
Moans and sounds of disgust come from the spectators, and with three sharp blows from his gavel, the judge quiets down the conversations.
People, he yells. I got a goddamn American soldier under fire trying to tell us the truth here, and the next person who opens his or her goddamn mouth is gonna regret it.
Pierce is staring at the screen, willing the video to remain in view for the signal not to cut out, and the judge says,
Go on, Major, please.
Cook says, It's my belief, sir, that the Rangers were sent home early, and that they were falsely accused of killing these civilians to keep their mouths shut about what they witnessed. And what they witnessed was your congressman, Mason Conover, committing this crime while under the escort of a Georgia National Guard captain, Emma Williams, your county sheriff.
Another boom from the computer. The screen goes blank, and the courtroom erupts in shouts and yells. Chapter 103, Afghanistan.
In front of me, Kurtz closes down his laptop and says, Think it'll work?
I sure as hell hope so, I say, trying to remain very, very still on a padded bunk bed in Kurtz's communications room. From where I can stretch out my arms, I'm in the Stone Age. But a meter farther away is the 21st century, probably edging into the 22nd, with computer terminals, display screens, surveillance equipment offering up views of the ridges and valleys around this observation post, as well as live feeds from two drones endlessly circling overhead. One of Kurtz's men steps in, speaks quickly in Pashto, laughs, and then heads out. I say, What do you think the Taliban are going to say about all those hand grenades your guys tossed over the side? Kurtz steps back and puts the laptop down among a collection of black boxes with blinking white and red lights that mean absolutely nothing to me.
Oh, that crazy American up there, losing his mind over something? As long as it helped you sell your story to that judge in Georgia, who cares? How's the pain?
Manageable, I say.
Good. He comes back to me, sits on a camp stool.
I won't be able to get you out of here until light.
I'll manage, I say.
What about Chief Salucci?
I've got two of my guys with radios standing guard so the locals don't steal his remains or screw with the little bird wreckage, he says. Either the Night Stalkers or a ranger unit will come in sometime tonight and retrieve his body. Destroy the wreckage. That's how they roll.
A little stab of pain makes itself known among my numbed limbs. I got him killed.
Kurtz reaches into a deep pocket, pulls out a Hershey bar, which he unwraps.
Nope. A two-man Taliban gun crew using a Soviet-made DSHK 1938 heavy machine gun brought him down. The chief was on a mission, even if an unauthorized one.
He takes a bite and says, Good thinking back there, pointing a Hershey bar at my guys when they found you.
I thought it'd work better than a pistol, I say.
He chews for a moment and says,
Got some stateside news for you that I dug out while you were talking to the judge. I'm sorry, it's not great news.
Tell me, I say. I think I'm about to pass out in a minute or two. He swallows.
There were a couple of news stories about a shooting in Savannah.
I know exactly what's happened.
Is she dead?
Nope, he says.
Critically wounded, in an ICU at some hospital in Savannah. Funny thing is, she's not alone. Looks like one of your guys is holding her room hostage.
My tongue is fuzzy. Alive, I think. Connie's alive.
How do you hold a room hostage? I ask.
He wraps up the Hershey bar like he's saving it for later.
She was shot while two gunmen killed a sheriff's deputy in her presence. Your CID guy is protecting her. Won't let anybody into her room except doctors and nurses.
You've got one hell of a team there, Major.
We do our best, I say. And then I just close my eyes and let things slip away.
Chapter 104. A number of years ago, Sheriff Emma Williams saw a great crime movie in which Robert De Niro played one cool fellow robbing banks and armored cars, and there was one piece of dialogue his character stated that stuck with her. Don't let yourself get attached to anything you are not willing to walk out on in 30 seconds flat if you feel the heat around the corner. Good survival advice, and she's taking it right at this moment. The heat isn't around the corner, it's coming at her like a burst of fire from a flamethrower. With the voices and shouts and the judge hammering his gavel, Williams calmly gets up and walks through the gate of the bar to the court side of the room and starts walking deliberately to a door she knows will lead right outside. Everything is gone. No time to mourn. Get the hell out, dump the cruiser somewhere on one of the unmarked dirt roads out there in her county, and pick up one of the three plain-looking pickup trucks she secured in different locations for just this purpose. Leave Sullivan County, lie low, and at some point, with a new driver's license and passport and access to funds electronically hidden in the Cayman Islands, get the hell out to one of the lovely islands of Micronesia in the Pacific, which doesn't have an extradition treaty with the United States. She gets to the exit door, ignoring the courtroom noise, including the shouts calling out her name. Captain Alan Pierce is standing next to Staff Sergeant Caleb Jefferson, intent on keeping the Ranger in one place, and he sees Sheriff Williams start to slip out the door. No, he thinks. Not on your life.
John! He yells, pointing to the sheriff as she goes through a door marked exit. Don't let her get away!
Huang looks both frightened and confused, and Pierce yells,
Lieutenant Hall Ass!
The doctor starts running. Outside now, in the blessed free air, her cruiser is right in the reserved parking spot. There are some people out there milling about, but it seems like the horrible news from Afghanistan that just dropped in the courtroom hasn't reached outside yet. When she's a few feet away from the cruiser, a man starts yelling at her. Huang pushes his way through a small cluster of courtroom officers in attendance, gets through the exit door into a short hallway. Left or right, he thinks, heart pounding. Right. Where a door leading outside is closing. He runs down the hallway, bursts outside, and there's the sheriff, just a few feet away from her cruiser.
Hey! He yells. Sheriff Williams, stop!
The woman turns around and, spotting him, just laughs. Huang is humiliated. What the hell can he do?
Don't you dare leave!
He yells again. The woman yells something obscene and opens her cruiser door. Huang gets to the parking lot, and knowing she's about to slip away in the next few seconds, does the only thing he can do. Like she's part of some dark comedy film, Williams hears that Chinaman yell out,
Stop or I'll shoot!
For real? She looks back, and what do you know, that army doc is running at her holding a pistol in both hands.
Doc, she yells at him, put that away before you hurt yourself.
He yells back,
I mean it, stop right there or I'll shoot.
Williams pulls out her service weapon and yells,
I mean it too, Doc.
And she fires at him, and there's return fire and a heavy blow to her chest. Huang stops, panting. He shot her. He can't believe it. He just shot her. Huang saw her pull out her pistol, and a bit of training came forth. He swerved and ducked, and, for all that's holy, heard the round whee overhead as he fired back. The sheriff is on the ground, writhing back and forth, clutching at her chest. He steps forward, his medical training kicking in, but before the doctor part of him can get to work, the army lieutenant works first. Huang kicks away her weapon, as an army officer would. Chapter 105.
A week after my return from Afghanistan, I'm in the hospital room of Special Agent Connie York of the U.S. Army CID. With me is Special Agent Manuel Sanchez, also of the CID, and Staff Sergeant Caleb Jefferson, 2nd Platoon, Alpha Company, 4th Battalion, 75th Ranger Regiment. The other two members of my squad are at their respective home commands, being debriefed, criticized, and probably disciplined. Captain Alan Pierce is at JAG headquarters in Washington, D.C., and Lieutenant John Huang is at the U.S. Army Medical Corps in Fort Sam, Houston, in San Antonio, Texas. As for me, I got a late-night phone call yesterday from Colonel Ross Phillips, who chewed me out between bouts of coughing. When there was a pause, I asked him, "Are you still in the hospital, sir?"
"Shut up," he said. "That's the mess you've made, Major. A pretty deep, muddy hole pissing off a whole lot of folks in CID, the Medical Corps, and JAG. But..."
I waited, daring not to say a word.
"But on the upside, you and your folks took out a pervert congressman before he became a pervert senator, which is nice. And you also saved 3 Rangers and the reputation of the Rangers, which means a big deposit in your depleted karma bank."
I asked him, "What about my group?" Knowing full well how experimental it was, but at that point he hung up on me. In the room, Connie is in a standard hospital bed, still bandaged about her head, her face horribly bruised and her eyes swollen, still hooked up to IVs and sensors, but breathing on her own. The doctors who've talked to me say that part of her skull is missing from where she was shot, and that she might have suffered some brain damage. Too soon to tell, although what is known is that she hasn't woken up yet. I'm sitting in a fancy padded wheelchair, both legs stretched out and in casts, and I also have a few stitches here and there. Sanchez is in jeans and a red polo shirt, sitting in one of the visitors' chairs, while Jefferson stands wearing a plain black t-shirt and khaki slacks. The Ranger looks uncomfortable, like he will never, ever allow his body to relax in civilian clothes. The mood is quiet and Sanchez says, "I know I'm not going to be charged with anything, but damn it, I'm tired of having the hospital security force trail me every time I go down to the cafeteria." I smile, but Jefferson stands like a polished statue of black granite. I catch his attention and say, "I'm sorry about Specialist Tyler. I wish it could have ended differently." For a moment, I think he doesn't hear me, but in a low voice, he says, "Not your fault, Major. Not his fault either. Everybody's got a breaking point, especially when you belong to a system that keeps on rotating these boys in and out, until they've done 4, 5, 6 deployments. They get trained to be the best wolves in the world, and then they're expected to come home and put that all away and become nice little sheep again. Be quiet, peaceful, and not raise a fuss." He shakes his head. "Until they're called up to be wolves again. The tour before our last one, there was a marketplace. A kid was coming up to us showing some DVDs he wanted to sell. Vinny was on point. There was something else in that bag, heavy, not a DVD. The kid wouldn't stop. The kid wouldn't stop, and after Vinny shot him, they found a fragmentation grenade in the bag with a trigger cord. Would have taken out our fire team. But Vinny, to him, he hadn't saved us. He had killed a kid." Then Jefferson clears his throat. "And Major Moore, our XO, he was trying to do right by me by protecting my stepdaughter, Carol. Look what that got him." He shifts and looks directly at me. "Tell me there'll be justice for Major Moore." I say, "With Sheriff Williams' arrest, her deputies are turning on one another like a mafia crew after their godfather's been nailed. From what I've heard, she's being kept in the Sullivan County Jail and the general population. Considering everything she's done, I don't think she's going to get a warm reception from her cellmates. Yes, Staff Sergeant, I'm sure there'll be justice for Major Moore." "Good," he says. We remain quiet for a while. On the small table next to Connie's hospital bed is my Bruce Caton book about the Civil War Glory Road. The cover's torn, some pages are damaged, and most of all, it smells of smoke in Afghanistan. It's battered, but still here, like me. But what now? I think about that Kipling poem. And again, I think, no, I'm not a soldier. I'm a cop. Just a cop playing make-believe army. Maybe it's time to put in for retirement, heal my legs and hip, and maybe heal my broken family. I tried calling my daughter Kelly and son Kevin, but neither of them returned my messages. Connie moves a bit in her bed. I reach over, take her hand. The Ranger says, "There's something else, Major." "What's that?" I ask. "An apology," he says, his voice still firm and low. "My guys, and other frontline grunts, you know how it is. We don't trust. don't respect, and don't much like you guys in the rear echelons. The paper pushers, the support staff, the pampered officers, the fobbits. But you and your crew, you worked for my fire team and me. Even when I was a thick-headed idiot and turned you away. You suffered, you put yourselves out there. You sacrificed for us when you really didn't have to. Excuse me for what I'm about to say, sir, but that's a fucking big deal. On behalf of my Rangers and me, thank you, sir. We'll never forget. My eyes seemed to get moist and puffy. I squeezed Connie's hand. Sanchez on the other side of the room was looking down at his sneakers. I say, it was our job, Staff Sergeant. And it was our honor as well. Quiet returns to the room until I hear a cough, and a weak voice says,
how the hell do you expect me to sleep with all you guys yapping? Shut up, will you?
Snap quick, I turn, and there's Connie. Eyes open, her mouth working, stretching some in her bed. Sanchez gets up and says, I'll go grab a nurse. Connie lightly squeezes my hand, and like the tough cop she is, immediately asks,
did we get her?
Yes, I say.
The Ranger's okay?
Staff Sergeant Jefferson is at the foot of her bed. Yes, ma'am. Thanks to you and your folks, we're all okay. Connie smiles, closes her bruised eyes.
That's good.
Sanchez comes back saying, two nurses are right behind me, Major. Thanks, I say. Sanchez says, it's going to get pretty crowded in here. It's almost 1 p.m. You want to step out, get some lunch? I squeeze Connie's hand once more and look at her. And then at the staff sergeant who's looking at me with something I've rarely seen from a combat soldier. Respect. No, I say, thinking of Connie and the army. I'm not going anywhere.
This has been a Hachette audio production, The Summer House, written by James Patterson and Brendan Du Bois, read by Ari Fliakos, produced by Robert Van Kolken, recorded at Merlin Studios, engineered and edited by Justin Kilpatrick. The Summer House is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2020 by James Patterson. Audio production copyright 2020 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.